Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test and automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And today, I have a very special episode as we speak with the author of 50 Quick Ideas to Improve Your Test, Goiko Adzik. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. So in this episode, you're going to find out how to test your software better, easier, and faster with the author of the 50 Quick Ideas to Improve Your Test, Goiko Adzik. Goiko reveals some of his favorite ideas from his book that apply to many different contexts, from small startups all the way to the world's biggest companies. This episode will help you and your team members collaborate better on defining, creating, and executing automation awesomeness. So many of you listening probably already know who Goiko is. He's a well-known strategic software delivery consultant who works with many teams to improve the quality of their software products and processes. He specializes in agile and lean quality improvements and is particularly known for agile testing, specification by example, and behavior-driven development. He's actually the author of one of my favorite BDD books, Specification by Example. So I was really excited to finally get Goiko on the show. His newest book is 50 Quick Ideas to Improve Your Tests, but he also has written some other recent books, 50 Quick Ideas to Improve Your User Stories and Impact Mapping. So I think this episode really is going to shed some light on how to make your test practices even better. And make sure to listen all the way to the end because Goiko is so awesome that he gives us a special way that we can get 50 Quick Ideas to Improve Your Test for 50% off for a limited time. So check it out. Hey, Goiko. Welcome to Test Talks.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
Awesome. So before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit how you get involved with software development and testing?
I used to work with a relatively dysfunctional organization, and we had an outsourced testing department. We had lots of people spread across the world who, you know, put in quite a lot of effort and didn't really produce anything particularly useful. And I kind of thought that that would be an interesting problem to try and solve. So I tried to solve it there, and then kind of it just took off from there.
Awesome. So I know you mainly from your books. One of my favorite books is Bridging the Communication Gap that you wrote.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. But today, what I'd like to talk about is you have it even, I think it's one of your newest books, is 50 Quick Ideas to Improve Your Test. So Goiko, why did you write this book?
So this particular book is around testing and mostly testing in a fast, short, iterative delivery style. It's part of a series called The 50 Quick Ideas. And the other book in that series is the User Stories book that came out about eight months ago. My colleagues are writing a book about retrospectives that's going to be part of the same series. So it kind of started with the User Stories book, and then we really liked the format and decided to write a couple of more books. At the moment, as I said, two are out. The third one is being written. And after that's done, we don't really have any concrete plans for what the fourth one is going to be. But everybody's pretty sure that we're not going to stop at three.
Well, that's good news because I really enjoyed this one. I'm going to go back and get the other two. What I really like about it is you give actionable advice and you give examples of how to actually implement some of the ideas that you present. The book is mainly broken, I guess, into four main sections. You have generating ideas, designing good checks, improving testability, and managing large test suites. So I want to start off with the first one, generating ideas. I work for a large organization with many teams. So how do teams avoid tunnel vision in the sense that they have a requirement and they have a happy path test that cover it, and then they stop there? How do you encourage teams to create better tests, I guess, the question?
There's a couple of heuristics that we typically use. One is, I think that's kind of quickly becoming the most popular idea in the book by Tom Roden, is to kind of look at the shaded figs heuristic that explores alternative emotions like the scary path or the dysfunctional path and things like that. It's kind of reminding people about what to test. But there's also, in my experience, kind of one very, very quite effective way to encourage people to look beyond the obvious stuff is to just put people with different backgrounds in the room and give them a whiteboard. Although it sounds quite zen and it sounds like, you know, a common sense, it's a really, really powerful technique. And I've seen amazing stuff come out when you put a bunch of developers and a bunch of testers in the room with a product person, and you just let people explore their ideas by being able to kind of write things that are non-commitment. I think lots of teams that fail to explore things enough tend to commit too quickly to what their test plan is. They start by writing test plans. They start by opening files and working in tools too quickly. And I think that's part of kind of the curse of our industry, is that we like tools too much. And as soon as you pull up a text editor or an Excel spreadsheet or a workflow visualizer, you're pretty much guaranteed to end with a table if you're working in Excel, or with a workflow if you're working with a kind of workflow management system. And people typically tend to struggle with bolds, italics, and formatting more than thinking about what else they would like to explore and test. So being able to diverge and explore lots of new ideas and then try and select a couple of representative examples from those ideas is an incredibly powerful technique that I keep using all the time. And it's pretty easy to do as well.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's great advice, not to get bogged down in tools and techniques right away. I guess that's the core reason to do something like, I call it BDD, but I think some people rather call it specification by example, is the collaboration piece. So it almost sounds like before you start your sprint, maybe you just get everyone in a room and you just communicate, here's the story we're gonna code against, and here's a whiteboard, and let's think of different case examples that could happen as we try to implement this story. Is that what you see as something that would be successful or helpful?
I mean, that was the original idea with stories. If if you read through the original materials on kind of stories before they were called user stories, I think I'm probably going to misquote Kent Beck now because I don't have the book with me now. But kind of, I think the explanation for the term story was that stories are told, not written, which kind of doesn't really work that well as a metaphor, because, you know, people were writing down stories even from the ancient times. So, but the whole thing was to avoid document handovers and replace them with collaboration, because in a fast-paced delivery environment, just not enough time to write down everything you want to write down if you're doing it alone, and then let alone for somebody to read all that. And the original idea with stories was, get people in a room, get them around the whiteboard, get them to talk to each other so they can quickly discover what they need to discover together. And somehow over the last 15 years, that's kind of morphed into this monstrosity where people write down all the details in a ticketing system and then follow the script.
It's so true. And I guess that maybe is one of the underlining reasons of, I guess you mentioned working with a dysfunctional team when we first started the call. And I've worked with dysfunctional teams also. And it tends to be around this dysfunction is that they ignore the reason why they're doing things and just get focused on maybe a definition of done and not necessarily why they're doing what they're doing.
Of course, I mean, there's a lot of that. And, you know, a lot of software gets built without any business goals in mind, unfortunately. But a lot of kind of process improvement in the industry tends to be copy and paste what other people have done. Yep. And I heard a fantastic presentation from Joachim Sunden at a conference in Finland, I think, a couple of months ago. He was talking about the Spotify model and the Spotify kind of tribes and things like that. Everybody's going on crazy about these days. And his key message was that kind of that kind of organization there emerged because of their company culture and just taking the organization and pasting it onto a company with a different culture is kind of never going to work that well. So it's pretty pointless to copy them as an example. What would be good is to kind of try and find a model that works with a particular company culture, or, you know, even better, change the company culture if possible to be different and then find a model that works there. So unfortunately, you know, a lot of the stuff people tend to just copy and paste for the wrong reasons. You mentioned BDD and spec, by example, and one of the most common complaints against tools that are used in that space is that tests become difficult to maintain and nobody wants to read them anymore and things like that. And that completely misses the point, because the key value out of that kind of process is the collaboration that comes out, not a better kind of automation. But people tend to kind of focus too much on the tooling part and skip the collaboration, and then kind of it's garbage in, garbage out.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And so, speaking about this collaboration, the book outlines some ways that you could kind of facilitate better conversations, I guess. And I guess some of them are heuristics. And one of them I really liked was the always never heuristics approach. Can you explain what the always never heuristic is?
Yeah, always never heuristic is kind of a fantastic tool I stole from Elizabeth Hendrickson, and she should get full credit for that. I don't know whether she invented it or whether she kind of took it from someone else, but I first came across that in her fantastic book, Explore It, and it says that kind of to provide a boundary around the discussions and kickstart the discussion around things you'd like to test, kind of try and list things that should always happen and just should never happen. And it's a particularly good heuristic because those kind of absolute statements are relatively easy to shoot down. And often we'd start with something where people would say, oh, a transaction should always be logged. And then it's easy for somebody to come up with an edge case, to try and come up with an edge case of a transaction that shouldn't necessarily be logged. And then we can start a discussion around, well, what classes of transactions go to logs? What classes of transactions just get rejected? Are there any classes of transactions that don't get logged and things like that? And that often opens up a whole new discussion around understanding and terminology, what people think is a transaction, is it a valid transaction, is it kind of a rejected transaction as well, and a lot of other things. So it's relatively easy for people to think about things that should always happen or that should never happen because they're kind of truthful absolutes. Likewise, for people who like nitpicking like I do, it's easy to kind of find holes in those absolute truths. And that's where the really interesting conversations start happening.
At what point do you know you have enough test examples for your feature that you're trying to implement? Is there a rule of thumb, or is it just as many as it takes to get rid of ambiguity of what it is you're actually developing?
I guess that's quite a general question, and I don't think there's a right answer to that. It all depends on the risk, like anything else. In a lot of situations, the teams we work with as consultants kind of tend to reach an agreement that they have enough information to proceed after a couple of kind of sessions of breaking down stories and coming back together to discuss examples. And I think a part of what especially Spec by Example brings to the table is this link to domain-driven design, where you try to find the right model and the right level of abstraction to describe something relatively simply and elegantly, but to kind of cover all the bases. And that's what, in terms of Spec by Example, the concept of key examples means. It's one of those fundamental things that, because people feel that they can understand in 20 different ways, often they kind of don't get the point. Frequently, we work with people that say, oh, you know, here are our five key examples and they're all positive scenarios. There are no boundaries explored. There are no edge cases. And you never know whether that's kind of the complete picture or not. And those five examples are key examples just because, you know, that's how much they could think of in 3 minutes. Where the teams that really get the value out of BDD and spec, by example, try to conquer the complexity of the domain so that they find the right level of abstraction, the right model to divide kind of their problem space so that they can describe things with relatively few, with groups of relatively few examples that all talk about relatively discrete concepts. And then they have another set of examples that talk about how those concepts interact with each other. And this is where, as I said, we start getting into modeling and the effect of testers and developers collaborating there also contributes to the software being developed with the right mental model, which is incredibly powerful because then we get systems that evolve much more elegantly and that are much easier to test, that are much easier to kind of evolve and things like that. I tend to put the question the other way around. What kind of model do we need so we can describe the thing with relatively few examples and we feel it's complete? At that point, you know that you're ready to move on. If you don't do modeling first, kind of pretty much everything else is painting the corpse. So you never know whether you're complete or not, but if you're able to create the right model for your software, and this is again why you need developers and testers and product people in the room to play around with those ideas before the development actually starts. If you have the right model in mind, then things will be relatively easy to kind of prove, and it will be relatively easy to kind of decide whether you have enough examples or not.
Great answer. I know when you first started that answer, you also mentioned risk, and I was speaking with Matt Heuser last week about risk. And so actually in your book, you have a good quick example, an idea about common risk that you have as a checklist. Do you find that helpful to help teams actually focusing on the stories that really matter or the scenarios that matter that could cause risk within their particular application?
Absolutely. One of the big problems with fast-paced iterative delivery is that it's difficult to keep sight of the big picture. When you have a continual stream of small tasks coming through, then people tend to focus their modeling, their development, their testing, their requirements, pretty much everything on that small chunk of functionality that's going through the pipeline or that small customer request that's going through the pipeline. And the overarching big themes, big risks, very rarely get looked at. And it's difficult then to kind of remember that you always need to look for certain things. People either go overboard and then duplicate their test ideas and their test criteria. So every story that deals with payments has to check these 500 things. But then you don't have enough time to discuss the details of that particular story, or they completely ignore the kind of big risk things and just focus on the details of the story, but then it's so easy for things to fall through the cracks. And one of the tricks that you've mentioned that we often advise to people is to create a global risk checklist. So that's, you know, 5-10 really, really important things that you absolutely want to look at for every piece of software going through the pipeline. And then people can use that as a reminder to think about the impacts of a small piece of software or a small change on the global picture and very quickly kind of discuss those things, but at the same time have a lot more kind of budget in terms of time and money and effort to put into the details of that particular story. So that strikes a nice balance between having enough focus on the change at hand and having enough overview of the big picture so that we can still keep things together.
Awesome. So I'd like to switch gears and go into the next section of designing good checks. And I think this ties in with something you've said previously about teams when they're writing their examples. You have some good things I didn't even think about before, but now they seem like, yeah, of course that makes sense, like avoid mathematical formulas. Do you think that sometimes if people use almost mathematical formulas as a way to pretend like they understand what they're doing rather than really exploring scenarios that they may not have thought of?
Yeah, quite often, actually. And that's, again, a modeling problem. Very often where kind of people without a deep understanding of what spec, for example, we are trying to achieve, get a request to provide given when then examples, what they tend to do is just rephrase the requirements they have on, you know, one piece of paper into given when then, as very often with mathematical formulas and things like that. And it's very, very easy for mathematical formulas to hide complexity that people with less domain experience or less knowledge about the problem might skip. Likewise, it's very easy for something that is a mathematical formula to seem kind of concrete and precise while still kind of hiding the details and not having a good discussion. We had a case, and I'm mentioning that in the book, where on an e-commerce site, there was a user story about allowing people to purchase things as long as they have enough money in the account. And the two critical examples that were given were something like, oh, if my account is 10 and the amount of the purchase is less than that, then it's fine. If it's greater than that, then it's not fine. But when people started using some concrete examples to discuss things, and one of the examples that came out was, what if you have $9.99 in the account and the thing you're trying to buy costs 10? We got into a really interesting discussion because the sales guys were kind of claiming that that purchase should be allowed because it's in the spec, and developers and testers were arguing that there's nothing like that in the spec. And the whole concept of enough money came out as something that we agreed, we understood completely differently. For developers and testers, enough money meant mathematically greater or equal than the amount of the purchase. For sales guys, enough money meant enough to make a solid profit, which kind of just by looking at a formula less than a money in the account, the sales guys kind of mentally went through that and said, yeah, that's correct. And nobody would spot kind of the whole problem with understanding what enough money actually means. But when we stopped using mathematical formulas and started using some concrete examples, that discussion came out. That's because concrete examples do not allow ambiguity to hide. And then you can use really, really good testing heuristics, and you can use kind of the knowledge and experience of the testers and the team to tease out these things that start a good discussion.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a great, great tip. Also, I love it when you say in the book that given when then is not just an automation-friendly way of describing expectations. I totally agree with that, but I find that that's really a hard habit to break. And I also that goes to the heart of managing large test suites, that if people have, you know, all these tests written just as an automation framework, that it's going to make it very hard to maintain over time.
Yes, so you know, that goes back to what we started talking about at the start of the interview, where I think one of the curses of this industry is kind of tooling up too quickly.
Right.
And often people perceive that automation makes things better, and it doesn't. Automation, by definition, makes things go faster.
Yep.
Sometimes faster is better. Sometimes faster is not necessarily better. Lots of fast food doesn't make you healthier. So, and often what I see, especially kind of working with teams that are stuck with a ton of automated tests they can't maintain, is that's exactly what they've done. They've done the fast food equivalent for testing, where they've written a ton of things that were really, really easy to write and easy to automate, but they don't work on the right model or abstraction. They're not influencing the way the software is modeled. They're not aligned with the business model. They're not looking at the key examples. And then kind of, yes, you have tests that are faster to execute than before, but that doesn't make them better. And as they accumulate, they start hurting more and more and more, because kind of when you have tests that hurt and you automate them, they just start hurting more and more often.
Absolutely. And it gets me to my next point, or the next part of the book, improving testability. I guess I'm creating layers and layers of hurt, but it's bad enough that if they create bad scenarios and bad tests, what's really harder is when they make them so they're hard to run against different environments. So I know you have a whole section on this, but do you have a favorite way to improve testability with tests? Like, how do you seed an environment across multiple, so that tests would run against multiple environments when you need to run them against different places?
One of the most critical techniques that I tend to use. And that helps with taking out environment dependencies, but it also helps with good test design and helps with so many other things that, you know, I think is one of the most crucial tools in a test automation toolkit is to separate what's being tested from how it's being tested. And that as an idea can be implemented in many different ways. That can be pulling out test data from the test runners and dividing those two. That can be implementing workflows for testing in a separate layer of code from the data that's being run through those test runners. Or in case of tools like Cucumber Fitness and Concordion, keeping the human readable page to describe only what we want to specify, what we want to test, and kind of keeping the automation layer purely for how we're going to test it and not what we are testing. Dividing what and how is a really good technique because it allows people to modify those two things separately. We can modify what we're testing separately from how we're testing it. We can modify how we're testing it without touching what we're testing. And that also means that we can provide multiple ways of running something. So we can provide multiple ways of running things against different environments. We can load up different configurations. We can very easily run things in parallel that can run in parallel on one environment or run them in sequence on another environment that's kind of more problematic for concurrent execution. And generally kind of dividing what and how into two separate, I'm going to say documents, but not really documents, two separate concerns, whether one, they might even be in the same file, but in separate layers, so they're very easy to modify, is a really, really good practice. And that's the first thing that I look for when I need to help a team solve their test automation problems. Very often, that takes care of 90% of their problems.
I guess the last part of the book is also one of the more important ones. So it's managing large test suites. And one thing you say, and I think it makes a lot of sense, but I guess that goes along with shifting left, is making developers responsible for checking. I guess the problem with that is, in my experience, once again, maybe it's just my limited sampling, it's hard to get developers to care about checking. So do you have any advice to fix that particular dysfunction?
Well, I mean, people generally don't care about testing. Like, you know, people don't care about the product. They care about what it enables them to do at the end of the day. Yep. So kind of getting people motivated to do something requires a more holistic picture. And that's, again, why collaboration is important. And in most organizations that we work with, there are many more developers than there are testers. So if testers are responsible for executing all the checks, that typically means that the pipeline is actually not moving at the speed of how much code 20 developers can produce. It's moving at the speed of how much code two testers can test. And at that point, kind of all the improvements that people put in development, like, you know, better design, better tooling, better practices and things that just do not matter because the pipeline is still moving at the speed of how much two people can test. And when things are positioned like that, often kind of developers start volunteering to speed up the pipeline and take some of the responsibility out. The responsibility for checking is something that makes a lot of sense to delegate to developers anyway, because, and I want to make sure that kind of we clarify things a bit here, because when I say the responsibility for checking, I typically mean for executing checks. Mm-hmm. Rather than for defining them. I think Developers, testers, and product people should be jointly responsible for defining the checks. But after the checks are defined, kind of because you're just looking for comparing expected outputs with known inputs, it shouldn't really matter who does those checks. Whether a tester does it, a developer does it, or a machine, it's much more important who defines the checks. So kind of given that most teams have more capacity in kind of in developers than in testers, distributing that kind of load to developers makes a lot of sense from the perspective of the pipeline speeding up. And then testers have a lot more time to participate in defining good checks and a lot more time to kind of do exploratory testing and look for unexpected things that can't be covered by kind of comparing expected outputs and kind of processes with known inputs and things like that. So in essence, the benefit for developers is a faster pipeline, but the benefit for developers is also much faster feedback. I'm primarily writing code these days, and one of the things I really, really hate is context switching. A lot of developers I know hate context switching as well, and kind of delayed feedback that comes from somebody else testing the code or kind of checking the code is often causing a lot of context switching, where by the time kind of a developer is deep into some other problem, you know, the report of the previous test comes back and then they have to stop what they're doing. They have to kind of switch and check the other thing. And in a larger company, somebody else might have modified the code already. So they have to go and kind of talk to some other people to figure out what they can change, what they can't change. And it just becomes a mess, where if executing the checks is delegated to developers, developers get immediate feedback on most of the stuff that they need to test anyway. So they can fix things there, and then they can use that to improve the design, and kind of they can make things testable in the first place when they do that, where kind of the testers can then do things that require a human brain, not just typing skills. At the same time, developers kind of get to solve the problem with context switching. They can speed up the pipeline significantly. So there are a lot of organizational benefits as well. And I think part of kind of motivating people to do that is to show that as a kind of as a big picture thing, where the organization is getting benefits, although people might do a bit of work that they don't necessarily like.
There's so many great ideas in this book. I can go on forever. I guess one more I just want to focus in on. It's just because it's something I've seen often also. And I guess it's along the same lines of designing tests together with other teams. A lot of times I see sprint teams acting almost like their own little world, where they're developing a separate product when they're really not. Any advice for how teams can design together, or what the benefits would be if teams are communicating with one another rather than treating each other as like this sprint team A and your sprint team B, and we never shall we talk or interact with?
In my experience with large organizations, the biggest risks to, say, quality of the product are often not within the work of one particular team. They're often at cross-team boundaries, because that's where the really ugly things happen. And that's because people very rarely kind of look at cross-team boundaries as something that's their responsibility, kind of.
Right.
So, you know, the responsibility kind of is a bit ambiguous there. Lots of information fall through the cracks and things like that. So there are some positive movements, especially kind of around microservices and things like that, that are forcing people to be much more conscious about the boundaries of their software internally to other teams and to other pieces of software. But even then, kind of the big question is, you know, who is responsible for defining the tests for those APIs? Is that the team that's consuming the API? Is that the team that's producing the API? And things like that. So kind of generally getting people who consume services of your team to at least discuss what they need from the software and kind of look at the tests is the same thing as involving customers or product people in designing the checks for a smaller organization. And that has the benefit of providing clarity, providing focus, avoiding over-designing solutions that don't need to be solved, making sure that kind of things that one team doesn't know about propagate from other teams so they can cover all the critical use cases and things like that. You know, there's lots of ways of making people work together, but more often than not, as long as they are supported in having those meetings and getting them to actually happen, people will find a way to kind of define who does what and where in that particular meeting. I mean, we had a classical case of this that I think I write about in the book. Is we worked with an analytics organization that had several teams working on the data warehouse solution. Two teams were cleaning up data internally. There were, I think, three or four teams that each worked with a separate third party to import the data. There was a team that was organizing the data in a way that made it easy to pull out reports. And then there were several client-oriented teams that produced reports for different lines of business. So the way requirements typically worked is, you know, people in the business would ask for a new report. This would get propagated to the first team. Then they would ask something from the second team. They would ask something from the third team. That would get delegated to the fourth team. And then at the end of the day, when everything is done by everybody, it comes together, but the reports were often incomplete, inconsistent, when people actually start looking at them. And a lot of missing information gets discovered only when the client actually starts looking at a piece of data. And then there was a lot of rework and a lot of recycling and things like that. So the only change these guys did was kind of made sure that for every team and every level there, their next client team participates in defining the test for kind of the critical pieces of functionality that come out. That allowed the teams to have an awareness of what's implemented where better, and it allowed them to have this kind of better clarity over what needs to get delivered. By writing those tests at the boundaries across the teams, they were able to kind of communicate a lot easier and get things done a lot faster than before, because information got discovered early on rather than kind of when everything comes together and everybody's done their part, but kind of just doesn't glue together well.
Great advice. And like you said, this example was directly from the book, 50 Quick Ideas to Improve Your Test. It's loaded with a bunch of examples, a bunch of great tips. It's so good. I bought the Kindle version, but I'm probably going to get a hard copy because it's just,
I'll send you a hard copy. The hard copies, you know, the funny thing about that is I really love physical books. I read most books on my Kindle because I travel so much. So carrying around physical books is difficult, but I love holding a physical book. And one kind of really nice thing we're trying to do with the whole 50 Quick Ideas series is to make really, really nice physical books. Nobody does that anymore.
Right. I agree.
And, you know, we've invested a lot of kind of time and effort and money in getting those books to be designed well, because that's part of the whole kind of user experience of having a book. And our idea with those books is for them to be not just a one-pass read, but a nice reference that people might want to keep with them all the time. And for that, you need a physical book. Maybe we can, you know, offer your listeners something like a 50% discount on the ebook.
That would be awesome. Yeah, because I think everyone should get this book. I'm serious. I'm not just kissing up to you. I think all my sprint team should have it. So any way we can get it into the hands of the listeners, I think it's really going to benefit a lot of teams. Okay, go. Before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their testing efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
One piece of advice to improve the testing efforts.
Yeah.
Kind of on a holistic level, I think getting people to collaborate is pretty much the most important thing that is missing from lots of teams. Testing in most organizations I worked with tends to be a solitary effort. It's something where, you know, things are written down in files and people work alone, and then they go through the whole thing, test it alone, and people tend to communicate through bug tracking systems, issue tracking systems, and kind of files, where the one thing that makes that work a lot better is a whiteboard and people in the room that are exploring ideas together. So that's kind of the big missing piece from a lot of it. And then everything else tends to fall into the place. The best way to contact me is probably my blog. That's goiko.net, and that's with a J, not with a Y. So it's gojko.net.
Thank you, Goiko, for your testing awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, including the link to how to get 50% off 50 quick ideas to improve your test, head on over to www.testtalks.com/62. And while you're there, make sure to click on the more info link to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And also, if you had a second, I would love it if you took some time to leave a quick review in iTunes. It really helps in the show's rankings, and I appreciate all the feedback to make Test Talks even better. So I just want to give a shout out to Kalyan, who was our Test Talks guest in episode 60. He left a review. So thank you, Kalyan. You're awesome. And actually, your episode was one of the most popular episodes that we've had recently. So thank you. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.